Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we're talking to Draconix, a prolific actual play performer, game designer, and producer who has written for Doctor Who the role-playing game, has appeared on My First Dungeon, Higher Education, and Three Black Halflings, and was the producer on the recent actual play stream, Beyond the Brook. Drac, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Oh my God, that's a cool introduction. I hope you live up to the hype.
You'll absolutely live up to it. Listeners of this show will certainly know that you'll live up to it.
Totally.
It's great. So it's great having you on. Obviously, we're big fans. We've had you on My First Dungeon a whole bunch of times, and you're a fan favorite. The goal of what we want to talk about today is talking about actual play performance and actual play production with someone who is, I guess until recently, primarily a performer. Though now you're moving much more into the producerial role. And the second thing we want to talk about is recently on Twitter, there was a big thread started by Rowan Zioli and then additional conversation about with Ned Donovan about funding actual plays and streams and like how we can make this a sustainable career to some degree. And so I know a lot of people brought up your name when people were like, who should we talk to? I was like, go talk to Drac.
That was truly surprising because when that happened, I was off Twitter because I was busy editing Beyond the Brook. So all day, I just wasn't on Twitter and I came back to several people in my DMs or several mentions. I was like, well, I don't know what's going on. What's happening? Why am I getting canceled? I don't know what's happening.
So just to start us off, just so we have like a reference point for who you are in 2024, what are you focusing on this year? Are you focusing on performance, production, writing? What's your life look like?
Right now, I don't have a plan. I'm kind of going with wherever the inspiration takes me at the moment. Like, I'm still doing a lot of writing. I still have a couple of projects I'm writing for, which I'm very excited to eventually announce. But I am finding myself maybe not shifting more to producer, but enjoying producing just as much as performing. I've already been doing a lot of production, honestly, from the beginning of my like streaming career, because I used to be part of Friends Roll Dice, which is a TTRPG Twitch channel. And my role essentially was to produce actual plays, whether it's sponsored or charity games, mostly charity games. I'd produce so many charity games. And then it just reached a point where I was like, I've learned so much through trial and error that I'm kind of getting the hang of this now, and I'm kind of enjoying this now. So I think this year is going to be a lot. I'm going to be producing a lot more, hopefully, fingers crossed, than last year. But I don't think there's going to be too much of a change of how much I'm performing. I think that's going to stay pretty consistent from last year as well. But yeah, I've learned a lot through like trial and error. And yeah, I'm happy to talk about what I've learned. I would rather no one else has to go through the error part of it. So if you can learn from my mistakes, please do.
Well, I guess that's maybe a good place to start. I think we had planned to start with you as a performer, but I like starting with the idea of the place where you think you have grown the most.
Yeah.
So I think Beyond the Brook is probably your biggest production to date, I would say.
I think so. Like money wise, no. but work and like work and vision wise, I think so, yeah.
So I guess from coming to a stream like Beyond the Brook from smaller charity streams or smaller like just fun streams, what are the biggest changes? What are the biggest things you've learned in that journey?
Yeah. The biggest thing I've learned is give yourself as much time as you can. Please, just give yourself as much of a space and buffer to produce as thing as you can. Beyond the Brook is incredible. I helped with the cast, and the cast is incredible. The GM is incredible. The support you've had has been incredible. But I definitely didn't give myself enough time to have it all done before we promised it would go out. And that wasn't too much my fault. It wasn't really anyone's fault. It just ended up in a situation where we were kind of like trying to line up with multiple timelines that we couldn't. Neither of us had control over. For Beyond the Brook specifically, it's because Die Hard Dice, the wonderful people at Die Hard Dice, sponsored us financially and made products for us. They made Beyond the Brook Dice. And right when we were going to start recording and have everything done, it was kind of like con season and like flu season. So everything hit at the same time, so we couldn't record and ended up recording almost last minute, and we couldn't push the date back any further because we're also trying to line up with the product line of the dice, and shifting it around to next year, this year, 2024, would have thrown their kind of plans and income out of whack. So we couldn't, I definitely didn't want to do that, especially this was my first product sponsorship. It's not really a product sponsorship because they are still giving us money, but product sponsorship as in there's a product directly tied to our show. I didn't want to put them under pressure or make them regret doing that with me. So we ended up kind of semi-rushing it. It's still an incredible, we still gave us enough time to do, produce a good show, but I think I'd have like more time to produce a good show and not be stressed. Because it's been very stressful.
From what I've discovered, no matter what, you will always not have enough time and you'll always be
stressed.
You'll
always want more time. Yeah. I guess for people listening, Drek, because they might be wondering, at what point are you sending that email to Die Hard Dice? Like, what does that initial outreach look like? Because I bet that's kind of what maybe somebody listening is wanting to know. Like, how do you actually make that connection, make that relationship?
I'll be honest, I won't give Die Hard Dice as an example because Die Hard Dice is a very special case because Beyond the Brick came out because of a tweet I made. I think I was rewatching Over the Garden Wall. So Beyond the Brook is an Over the Garden Wall inspired actual play. And I was watching Over the Garden Wall one day and I finished watching it. And I just tweeted, damn, it would be cool if I produced an Over the Garden Wall inspired actual play. And then tweeted it. And I tweet stuff like this all the time of like ideas. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm not going to do it. Someone else can do it. I'm just going to throw it into the ether. And then Die Hard Dice reached out to me and was like, we love Beyond the Brook and we love Over the Garden Wall. If you do this, we'll love to support you. And I was like, damn, I guess I have to do it. Like, if there's money right there and incredible people want to support us right there, I kind of have to do this. So Die Hard, that's definitely a special case. But other actual plays I produced, I'll actually give Enemy of My Enemy as an example. I produced a Vampire the Masquerade, Hunter the Reckoning mashup, where we had vampires and hunters having to fight, like, work together to fight a greater threat. And I produced that for Demiplane, the VTT. And the kind of stage I pitched that to them was when I had pretty much everything except for the actual footage. I had everything down from like cast and GM. I had the budget down. I had potential artists, or at least potential artist rates down. Truly, I had every single thing I could possibly need except for the money. And then that's when I would pitch it to them. Because at least for me, from what I've learned, people paying you just want to pay you. They don't want to have to do anything else. So as long as you show that you have everything else down, that's when you're in the best position to actually start recording and or getting the sponsorships. So yeah, I had like everything from cast to tech producer to editor to cost of a custom intro, the hours and the hours we wanted to do it, wanted to have the actual play be, the days we wanted it to be, and pitched it to Debbie Plain as a way to promote their VTT, because that year Vampire the Masquerade was just hitting Demiplane. So we're like, hey, this would be a cool way to get people to see it in action. Do you want to do that? And they were like, they were very excited about it. They usually, I'd expect them to be like, yeah, sure, here's like a measly amount of money to do it. They gave me exactly how much I budgeted and I was like, there you go, take it, do what you need to do. But yeah, I would always have everything like right down to the minute figures down, at least budget wise, of what you want. And if you can get cast as well, I think that's good as well, because you can leverage that as potential reason why they would want to sponsor you.
I do want to just highlight two things there, because I think you said a lot there that I want to highlight, but two things in particular. One is just because I think this is a great phrase, the people paying you just want to pay you. Don't make them do any other work. Grab it already.
Yep.
Which is great. But I think what you did there coming to Demiplane was incredibly smart of, you're not saying, hey, I want to run a game, would you want to sponsor me? You're saying, hey, you've got a new virtual tabletop that you want to promote. Here's a great way to promote it with some great people. Here's all the information you need to know. Is this an interesting collaboration? Like, here's something I can do for you. This is the collaboration we'd want, rather than, hey, will you do something for me? I can't really offer you anything, but you can put your name on, yeah, on our thing.
Right. The best pitch is a no-brainer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I think, but I will also say I've done like many different types of pitches. Like that Demiplane was very like very targeted. Like I'd reached out to Demiplane earlier for a different actual play. And they were like, you're not playing a game that we have on our product, on our site. So we're not going to sponsor you. But please reach out to us when you do. And then, yeah, that when that idea kind of sparked my mind of Enemy of My Enemy. It also kind of came along with Castlevania, which was already like people were very excited about vampires and monster hunters working together. So around that time, I was like, wow, this is a good idea. I have people who would be really interested in this. And Demi Plane has already shown at least, I don't know if, even then I wasn't sure if it was like polite interest of being like, sorry you can't, but reach out to us later, and had no intention of actually following up. But I was like, I'm going to follow this lead just in case. I see where it could be useful in their case, and I see how it could help me produce a vision, the art, I guess, I wanted to make, and went along with it. But I have also done, also Beyond the Brick is also an example of this, but also Our Lives After, which is another actual play I've been doing kind of sponsorship outreach for. And I've reached out to like just a bunch of different companies, like dice companies, TTRPG companies. I reached out to a video game company to sponsor. I think there are different ways to go about getting sponsorships and funding. And some are definitely easier than others. Like, I think the easiest way is definitely being like the way I did with Demiplane, being like, hey, you have a product, I'm going to use your product, pay me to use your product. But it is very possible to do it a different way where like you're just like, hey, do you want us to advertise your name on stream, your logo on stream, your company on stream? It's just about how you go about that. Like ad reads is a good way to do that. Or for streaming specifically, we have break ads. Where like we would stream for like 3 hours, by the halfway point of like a 5-10 minute break, and we just roll ads during that time. We just have social, we also sell kind of like social media ads, I guess, of us using product, and we post on social media. You might actually see one soon because we're sponsored by Hero Forge. So I showed off us building our characters on Hero Forge, and it's going to be a thing we post on social media. We kind of like offered that to Hero Forge, and we're like, yeah, we'll pay you for that. There are many avenues to around how to get funding, and it will probably take me ages to go through all of them. I think either going through like stuff like crowdfunding, like Patreon, or actual crowdfunders like Kickstarter or Crowdfunder is one way that I'm going to be exploring a bit more in the future, probably this year, maybe next.
Because you did Beyond the Brook on Kickstarter?
Yeah, so I'd initially done Beyond the Brook on Kickstarter. We had a much loftier goal then because we wanted to get like very custom metal dice, which is a lot more expensive than the acrylic that we ended up getting in the end. We want to get custom metal dice limited edition with it to like incentivize people to put some money on into the campaign. Fortunately, that didn't pan out. And from that, I learned again to give yourself more time. I did not give myself enough time to run a whole Kickstarter. That's definitely a thing I've learned. I'm going to definitely do better next time. But yeah, there's like Patreon is a big one. My friend Stella, a lot of their campaigns and like miniseries are funded by their patrons. And then the one I've been like really kneeling into is the sponsorship outreach, just reaching out to companies that might be interested.
When you, and let me know how comfortable you are getting into the specifics, when you're reaching out to these companies and you're presenting a budget, just so like we're kind of putting some numbers to this, what are the numbers you're asking companies for that are the reasonable ask? And have you had learnings where you've realized the number to a company is an unreasonable ask from their perspective?
Yeah. So I always give, no matter who the company is, I give the full budget. And I think that's just nice so they know where the money's going. I think that's always, like, I have no actual experience whether or not this is a peace of mind kind of thing for them. But I just personally think, like, if I'm going to give someone money, I would like to know where the money's going exactly. So I always give the full budget and the breakdown of the budget. But when I ask for companies to sponsor us, it's never... Demiplane was a rare occasion. Demiplane paid it fully. Most of the time, it's like I have like package deals, basically, for Our Lives After. It depends on the size of the company we're speaking to, for one. We try not to ask, like, if you're a small company, we're going to be like, give us $500 for one ad space, because that's just not really feasible for like a one-person company. So we definitely like tailor it to the people we're speaking to. But usually we have packages of like one ad space. And there are two different type of ad spaces for us. There's the rotating ad and the break ad. And the rotating ad is just like a logo in the corner of the screen, and it just like rotates throughout the episode. And the break ad is like a short, like 30-second video that we play at the break point, the halfway point of a stream. We have the custom ad read, which is the one I recently added. I hadn't done that previously. But custom ad read, we like record and read out, do a custom ad, and we, one, put that in our stream, again, at the break ad point, but also give the company, like, depending on how much you want to charge them, like, 1 to 2 months license to use on their social medias. So they can post it on their places as well. So that's another package we usually have. And then we have like another package like a break ad in every episode. So then like we do that, but it's slightly cheaper than buying it individually to just incentivize them to go for the full break package rather than the individual break package. And then we have like a ultimate package where they're like, they get everything from previously, plus they get to be like, take a bit more credit on social media and any posts we make of being the reason why we're able to do this thing. And that's like a bigger package. That's usually like the breakdown we have. All of this I learned through my friend Vanna, actually. So I didn't, with this section specifically, I didn't go through any trial and error really. Vanna, Havanarama on Twitter, I believe, or Vanna on Twitch, has been doing this for a very long time. They were on Geek & Sundry, they've produced a bunch of their own TTRPG stuff. And they let me kind of learn. They fully brought me to a corner. I was like, here's what I do, here, blah, 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 here's everything we do. And kind of learn from there. And that's how I kind of learn the breakdown of the packaging. I do think though, try not to give everyone like a cover, like don't give everyone the same thing. There are some companies who can pay you more, so ask for more. There are some companies who can't pay you more, so don't ask them for that much. But yeah, I don't have any figures that I'd feel comfortable giving.
Totally. That's fine.
But yeah, that's kind of like how I've gone about it so far. And it's worked so far.
This is particularly interesting for us because we're moving into a phase with My First Dungeon where we haven't done mid-roll ads up till now. And we're just starting to like begin that process. Elliot, you've worked in podcasting for your day job for a long time, so you have much more experience with this. But usually with larger productions or like you're reaching out to more traditional sponsors, whereas we're trying to reach out to like gaming companies and dice companies and things that would be interesting to our listener and that we'd like feel comfortable promoting. But a lot of those companies are, as you said, like run by one or two people or are very small, and they only have so much money to give for advertising or for community building. And it's trying to make sure that you are if they're going to spend their money with you, you want to give them the best thing possible and also be better than what anyone else can offer.
Absolutely. So you said that the budgeting and stuff you had kind of a good mentor for, so there wasn't the, you know, trial by fire. What would you say are some of the bigger things that you had to kind of do a trial by fire and learn the hard way that you'd want to pass on?
I think the trial by fire was definitely like just learning how to produce at all. Like tech production is a lot of big thing I do. So I'm usually behind the scenes doing actual techs of moving cameras, setting up cameras and all of that. I learned that through just either YouTube videos or absolutely failing live on stream and then figuring it out live on stream. There was a lot of just general the initial outreach was definitely like a trial by fire. Less of the like making mistakes, but more of learning how many no replies you get. I think I reached out to, so I helped with higher education. I helped Banner out when we did sponsorship outreach. And I think altogether, we reached out to maybe 150 to 200 companies and got maybe 10, 20 replies. And out of those replies, we got maybe 5 yeses. So it is a lot. So that's definitely like a trial by fire of like I need to get used to this. I got used to it pretty quickly. I need everyone listening, just have like a template, a copy pasta template.
Yeah.
Don't write individual emails. It's, at least for me as an introvert, as someone who like definitely gets drained from like interactions, I like need my own like personal space to recharge. Writing up special emails every single time for every single company is the most draining thing I've ever done in my life.
I'm a big proponent of having one section in your template, yes, that you can personalize, you know, yeah, like.
And God, please, also, another thing I learned through Trial by Fire is make sure you personalize it. Make sure you don't forget and accidentally copy pasta a thing you sent to another sponsor to the new one. Because again, totally, at least for me, I will die on the inside and never speak to them again. I'll be like, oh, that's a bridge burnt, never again.
I almost did that yesterday. I was about to send out an email and I like, for some reason, I was like, why don't I read it one more time? I know, yeah, this is a complete copy paste job, but like, let me read it one more time. And buried, mm-hmm, in the middle was a different company's name. Yeah. with a very specific thing about that. Like, it couldn't even be construed, yeah, as
exactly,
anything else.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I saved it. We're good.
Yeah. I've made that mistake in a professional context in my day job in, like, my first year of working as a producer. It was like, Oh, that was the worst sinking feeling ever when you do that. But I do want to underline really big before we move on to your other tips, and I do want to get to them. 150 to 200 companies outreach to.
Yep.
15 or 10 responses, 5 yeses.
Yep.
Like that, it's a numbers game when it's coming to like, when it comes to, you know, putting out asks like that. So I just want to make sure people heard that and absorb that, that like, it's like, you know, the more people you reach out to, the more, the better your likely chance you are of getting that percentage that responds.
I,
and that
I truly think of everything on the internet or even just like any kind of creative professions, like your conversion rate is going to be 1% for everything.
Yeah.
Like 1% is probably pretty good. So like if you have 1,000 listeners, expect to sell one hat. Or so, you know what I mean? It's going to be...
What a specific example, Brian.
What a very specific example.
Sorry, Dre, continue.
No, you're good. I definitely would, just to go back to the whole copypasta tip, highlight the section that you want to personalize in a very bright color, because then when you copy and paste, you're like, oh, why is this bright red? Oh, because I haven't added the personalized section here yet. That's what I always do, because I always forget that. I highlight mine in red, like just bold red section of this section is personalized. Make sure you read over it. But yeah, I think, yeah, it's definitely a numbers game. I definitely want to go back to that. It's a numbers game, but also, and especially with actual plays, because it's such a weird space. It's not, it's like mainstream, but not mainstream. So not many, there are many people who know what it even is. So they won't be able to see the use or the purpose of like advertising or sponsoring something like that, especially if you're reaching out to outside of just like dice companies and game video game companies. Definitely sell yourself in a different way depending on who you're selling yourself to. See, dice companies and like video game companies is a lot easier to do. For example, the video game company I reached out to is producing a, like, I think literally is like a D&D inspired video game. So I was like, hey, D&D inspired video game, D&D. Do you wanna collab? Do you wanna work together? Sounds like a lot easier. But if I were to reach out to like Logitech or something, like it'd be a lot harder to just say, hey, we have something in common, let's do this. In those cases, you're probably gonna wanna go more of a numbers game or like a community thing of being like, hey, you wanna build like buyers in my community, you wanna build buyers in a TTRPG community. Look at my numbers, look how many people listen or watch my stuff. And really lean into that. Because definitely, we're very lucky in the AP space, in the TTRPG space, that a lot of people are just willing to help for the sake of helping. But unfortunately, it doesn't really stretch out beyond the TTRPG space.
I guess one of the other questions I had in this is, as far as sponsors go, is there anything that you would recommend looking at once you kind of start getting the like the tentative yes? Have you ever had any particularly good or bad experiences with sponsors? And was there any, like, did you notice anything going into it? It's like, oh, I know this is going to be good, or, ooh, this looks like a bit of a red flag. I should be wary of this in the future.
And you can fully anonymize, obviously.
Yeah. So it's never been a case of like it was too late. I've had incredible experiences. I think most of my experiences have been incredible. Like Demiplane was amazing. The creative freedom they gave me and the rest of the cast was incredible. The support they showed was incredible. The CDO themselves was like, hey, this is great. Like, I got to talk to them at Big Bad Con, and they were like, I absolutely loved what you did with Enemy My Enemy. So, like, they were incredible. I think the only bad experience wasn't, like, a bad experience. It was just a red flag, like you mentioned, that I caught on, and we cut relations with the sponsor. And we learned that the sponsor, I think literally the day or two after they said yes to sponsoring us, we learned later on that they'd been kind of abusing their writers, like been really, really weird about disclosing pay and actually paying the writers, really weird about giving credit to writers. They had some big names on the project and would only really highlight those big names and not everyone else. Like, I think there was literally one of the writers sent me a screenshot. It was literally the first page. We had like the big names and like huge letters, and then the other writers were like tiny small prints like at the back of the book. And I was just like, that's weird. That feels uncomfortable, especially when they're hiding pay as well. It makes me kind of think like, what's going on there? So we kind of cut ties with them pretty immediately. And I think that's only bad experience I've had, and it wasn't like an experience. It just caught it.
I think it's a good highlight for people, though. Like, look into the people. Also, like, it's a numbers game. You can reach out to 150 to 200 companies, but also, like, before you sign paperwork and like make a professional relationship, like, make sure you know, have done a little due diligence on the company, because like it will just, you know, derail the show and derail like all these people's lives who you've involved when you realize that like there's something morally wrong that you don't want to involve yourself with anymore, or God forbid you make it. I remember there was some stream or show this past year that had a sponsored season and they ended up scrapping the entire show, which I think like was like a very admirable decision. And I'm not necessarily saying that they didn't do their due diligence. I don't think there was in that particular situation knowing, but you know, you just end up, the later things like that are figured out, the harder it becomes to manage.
Moving away a little bit from funding actual plays and just kind of into producing actual plays, I'm curious, I was like hearing people's metrics, like internal metrics of what makes like a good versus a bad X. So as far as like actual play producers, actual play streams, what do you think makes a good actual play producer versus a bad actual play producer? Or what do you think are the traits of a really good producer?
I think these are even traits I'm still working on. But I think clear communication is probably the biggest thing, especially with actual plays where it's hugely collaborative, not just on screen, but behind the camera as well. Having being very succinct about what your role is and what everyone else's role is, and sticking to that. Because the last thing you want is to bring these people on as a GM or as performers and ask them to do more than that, than they signed on for. So being really clear about what they're coming in with is really key. Because what else? I guess organization is very important. You're going to be sending a lot of emails. You're going to be trying to keep track of a lot of different things, from art to whether or not you can actually get to recording or the live stream, to your own tech, and making sure that you have the tech you need to, if you're doing tech production, do the tech production. So having like being able to organize that and handle the organizing all of that, or delegating those tasks. A thing I definitely learned with Anywhere My Enemy specifically is that in the TTRPG space, a lot of the time the GM is also the tech producer, and that's all well and fine. But I wanted it to be a case of like the GM just focuses on GMing, like literally nothing else. They're just GMing. And I did that for Anywhere My Enemy. And Dylan, our GM for that game, was like, I've always been the tech producer and the GM. This was so freeing, just worrying about the story and not about tech. Like, this was incredible. And like, that kind of clicked with me. Like, and I think Anywhere My Enemy was definitely like an eye opener of like, I could do this more. Like, this is, I think this role is a thing people want. And that was through that experience. So like, and again, like GMs are often also the producer. Often GMs are also the one doing the outreach to sponsors. They're also the ones doing like any contract signing, contract work. So being able to take that and delegate it to myself or to other people is going to really, I think, highlight and really boost your actual pre-production in the end. And I think having a good actual scope of what you can do is really important. Having lofty goals is great and all, but if you can't meet them, and especially if you have sponsors and you're promising those lofty goals to sponsors, not meeting them is going to be incredibly detrimental to you going forward and to that actual play as it's going on.
I think realism is one of the best skills of a producer of any kind. You know, being able to be realistic about budgets and what you can do and final products and stuff like that, I think is like almost a stereotype of producers, of like being overly realistic sometimes. Yeah.
It's really just the person who's able to continue moving forward regardless of what's happening. You're just walking into a stiff wind and you don't stop. That's all you have to imagine. You just keep going.
Yeah.
I'm curious what the kind of maybe softer skills you use as a producer that are maybe related to the specifics of it being like a actual play of playing a game. Are there things that you're like doing in those early stages that you think are like specific skills to the actual play producer versus like to the producer at large?
Oh yeah. I think consume actual plays, I think, is a big thing, because so you can know what it is you're making, I guess, specifically, and what you want to innovate, what you can even innovate. I've had a chance of playing up a bunch of actual plays, and I've been behind the scenes in a bunch of actual plays. So I kind of know how it works. So I know what stories I can tell in it and kind of flex those skills. So a lot of the time I'm also like a creative producer. At the very least, with having a basic concept, and I basically pay people to make the basic concept a thing. Like Any of My Enemy, I came up with like vampires versus vampires working with hunters. And I just look for people who want to tell a story like that. And I did the same with Beyond the Brick. I was like, Over the Garden Wall, actual play. I'm going to look for people who want to run or tell that story, and I'll do everything else behind the scenes for it. So I think knowing the industry or kind of the space you're kind of trying to make an actual play in is really important. And God, soft skills, specifically AP, I don't know, because I think I end up learning that a lot of it is just taking the general production skills and just moving it to
totally
actual plays.
I think I'd identify one that you kind of just mentioned, which is in addition to consuming APs, you also consume and know games really well.
Yeah.
So that you can then have ideas like, here's how we combine these two games in an interesting way, or here's how we take this game and use it to, well, obviously, yeah. Babes in the Wood is a pretty direct, like, one-to-one to over yeah. the, but like, you've come up with a number of really creative ideas for shows. And so I think that, like, being a consumer and fan of games is key to being a good actual play producer as well, so that you, like, know the systems and possibilities.
And coming into something with the idea of what can I do different, what can I do better, what can I innovate, just kind of answers the question for the audience of why would I watch this show versus this show?
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's something great to telling, you know, a story you've seen before that can still be fun. But when you come to it and are like, I'm going to do this, but with this twist, I'm going to do this, but we're going to do this big thing, we're going to change this one thing, it really makes it a lot easier to get the foot in the door for an audience.
Yeah. No, like with, I remember I bought Babes in the Woods I think it was at Big Bad Con as well a couple of years ago. It was my first Big Bad Con, I think 2 years ago right now. And I remember reading through and I was like, wow, this is really cool. This is really fun. Like, I would love to see people play this. And I remember looking it up and finding basically no actual place of Babes in the Woods. So kind of like sat in the back of my head of like, oh, that sucks. I really would want to see like how this plays. Because I learn teach RPGs a lot more by playing and watching rather than just reading through them. That's usually how I like gauge whether or not I like a system. And I saw that there was none. And I remember when I had the idea for an Over the Garden Wall and it's about an actual play, I remember looking again to see if there's any Babes in the Woods actual plays when I had the idea. And there were a few around, but all like one shots, and none were like spanning arcs or campaigns. So I kind of like knew that there was a space for that in that region. And literally a couple of months afterwards, HBO Max was like, we're removing Over the Garden Wall from our streaming service. I was like, I guess the people need it.
Yeah, bastards.
I remember we were talking about seasons for My First Dungeon, and one of us brought up Babes in the Woods. We're like, oh yeah, Over the Garden Wall, it's fucking awesome. And then like the next day you announced Beyond the Brook. You were like, okay, we'll check that off for now. Well, maybe later.
Beyond the Brook, Ed and I, the GM is Edward Spence, and I, we edit it. So we do like the soundscape and music and all of that kind of stuff. And I remember Ed talking to me, be like, I was looking to My First Dungeon's Orbital Blues, and that's really what I want to do with the music. I really want to really hit the tones and like the vibe of Beyond the Brook with the music the way Orbital Blues does on My First Dungeon. So honestly, we might have done it before you could, but you're inspiring us as we're going along with it.
Yeah. I'll take it.
We'll give you Behold's number for making some characters and stuff.
Truly, next time, so we don't have the budget for like custom music, we're using Epidemic Sound, but I am absolutely going to be putting the next project, I want like more custom music, and I'm definitely going to be hitting up Behold for that.
Hell yeah.
Everyone, go hire Behold for your custom yes. TTRPG music. He will be thrilled.
He will be thrilled and he'll crush it.
we're just going to slowly... I feel like I just want to keep pushing him up the hill so he becomes Magic Sword.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom. or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Annie Award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
So as a producer, you're trying to do a lot of new things. You're trying to innovate. And I feel like every good producer is always looking at that, like, what's the thing I can do different? Kind of just getting a sense of your taste, both as like an actual play listener and consumer and as a producer. Is there anyone you'd want to shout out or highlight in the streaming actual play space or in the podcast actual play space that you think is doing that well to some degree, is doing something particularly well?
I would check out, obviously, My First Dungeon.
Shout out.
Shout out. If you're not already listening, you should be to all of their stuff. Also Transplanar. Transplanar doing incredible work when it comes to actual play production, especially with the limitation of it being remote. They've done an incredible job of still keeping it engaging and continuing to, one, build, like, grow an audience while also not playing D&D, which I think is very hard. Transplane has been doing a thing where they're playing like different indie systems to kind of, in the same like world, same campaign, same characters, but different indie systems to kind of denote different arcs in their story. And I think they've been doing an incredible job at that. And they've added such, I don't know, it's just so engaging and fun to watch. And you very quickly understand why they have such an incredible fan base, because they're all fans of each other as well. And they're always trying to push a bit further and a bit further and really innovate how and what you're watching every single time. Started recently streaming the actual plays on TikTok, which I don't think I've ever seen until recently.
I saw that. It's interesting.
Yeah. And it looks great. And I need to ask, see how they do it, because I'm very much considering doing that as well. But yeah, definitely Transplanar. God, I can't remember. So there's one, it's very big. I'm sure everyone's listened to it. Worlds Beyond Number is doing absolutely ridiculous stuff with podcast actual plays. The music's incredible. The role playing, of course, is incredible. But like, I think it's really, really for me is the world they build with the sound. That's the thing that I've been trying to lean into more as well with the actual plays I want to produce. I want to really build out the soundscapes of things, because I've always been a huge podcast listener. A lot of my actual plays, my first actual plays I listened to were podcasts. But then through that, I found audio dramas, and I found that they are very different, but you can make them a lot closer and more similar, and it would only enhance the experience of APs. And so literally any AP that does that, My First Dungeon, Worlds Beyond Numbers, huge inspiration to me, and a thing I kind of want to get more into as I'm producing.
It is a thing that I think because Worlds Beyond Numbers and My First Dungeon are both podcasts, there's only so many things you can like enhance to make it better. And most, it's like you can add sound design, you can add music, you can add background and stuff, you can add effects. And all that stuff, in the same way that on a stream, when really interesting streams like play with the overlays in a certain way, A, it's just like engaging and fun and interesting to watch and listen to and stuff. But also it, you know, I love actual plays. I love Dimension 20. Every season of Dimension 20, even though I know I'm going to love it, the first hour is still tough for me to get into. You just kind of have to, it's, and I am the target audience for this thing. And I've still got to kind of like push my way through it a little bit. The more you're able to do something interesting and immersive with with overlays, with sound design, with music, just the little bit easier it becomes. And like getting someone from minute 2 to minute 5 is way harder than getting them from minute 55 to 56.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. I definitely had like, and it's still a kind of thing that I think actual plays, streamed actual plays, especially remote ones, I'm still trying to figure out. Like, I won't lie, I got to have a lot of fun in Beyond the Bricks overlay, but it's still very static. And I think in future projects, I want to make it more dynamic. But with Beyond the Bricks, some things I've been doing has been like showing changes to the characters on the character arts in the overlay. So one of the characters, for example, is played by Stella, the wonderful Stella Luna. The character name is Penny, and they play basically a honey elemental, like just truly a blob of honey elemental. And part of the story is that a lot of the things that are sweet in the woods, in the backwoods, that's what we're calling the woods that we're traversing in, is becoming like spoiled and sour. And that includes Penny. So as the episode goes along, you'll notice that Penny's arms start to become like pitch black and start to decay and sour over time through the campaign, because I've just been messing around with the overlay in post and having like gradually changed throughout the episode. Or there are scenes where the fiend, which is the beast in our world, the fiend kind of like isolates one of the players, and we kind of denote that by the overlay turning like wintry and dark, and the other players get blacked out, and it's only Ed, the GM, and the player that's been isolated. And we kind of like played around with it, very small things, but I think it's from the reactions the audience have seen, things that aren't done. Because everyone watching is like, this is ridiculous. And I'm like, is it ridiculous? I just changed the transparency. I just messed around the transparency on this filter, on this overlay. But yeah.
But there was a clear intention as to why, which is... Yeah.
And that's a good thing to highlight of like, it's not a huge thing. I'm not, you know, we're not saying you've got to learn After Effects and do crazy, you know, 3D motion graphics. You can. I'm sure that'd be great.
Yeah.
But just doing those little tiny, very intentional things does a lot.
It's sort of the equivalent of like the light pan in sound design, like does a lot of work. You know, not that it accomplishes everything in sound design, but like that first time you hear an audio drama or an actual play, like for me, Drac, I came into podcast listening through audio dramas as well. And that first time you hear something just in your left ear happening somewhere over here, you're like, what kind of sorcery is this?
And that's just like a very simple little technique. Like,
yeah.
It scratches an itch. I don't know. It's great.
It scratches an itch. But that's not a super complicated, you know, sound design technique once you get into it, but it's those little pieces and they all add up. So Drac, as we're sort of winding down towards an end, I'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge Drac the performer in addition to Drac the producer, because that's how we've, you know, worked with you entirely. Actually, this year we had you on Die and we had you on Yzeba's, and then most recently Orbital Blues with Blank, who is one of my favorite characters of all my First Dungeon. I'm curious, not having sort of a like, you know, Brian mentioned earlier, you don't have like a home show necessarily. Like, what have you sort of learned about performance playing with so many different tables?
I think the biggest one, at least for me, is that not every table is going to be your table. I've been brought on by some really like incredible shows, and I had a lot of fun with it. But definitely, like, this is just a guest thing. Like, I don't think I'd enjoy it to be. I like to be more than just a guest on this. But I also learned, like, you kind of have to be pretty adaptive as well. Because, like I said, just because, like, even the tables that are for you are still going to be very different between each other. So they might have different, like, pre-show stuff. Luckily, a lot of my stuff has been, like, just session zeros. All of them has been, like, session zeros and have been kind of fairly similar. They might have different, like, rituals. Like, rather than, like, stars and wishes, they might have thorns and roses. They might have, I think it was one, like, Bumblebees and Hornets was one another one that I learned very recently, which is very, very cutely named. So, like, every table is different, and that means some might be great for you, some might not be, and some might have different, like, practices before and after, some might not have any at all. And I also learned that, especially if you're a guest, I think communicate with the GM as much as you can. I've really enjoyed it when the way I play when I'm a guest is I want to be almost a second GM, of where I don't need to ask the GM too much for questions. Like, I front load all the questions before the stream of like, okay, cool. What if they ask for this? Can I do this? Can I do that? Do I know any lore about this world? So that then whenever there's a thing that my character would know. I also know it. I don't have to go, hey, GM, do I know that? And that's kind of like just a thing for me. I feel it's a lot more fulfilling to feel like a tool that's been properly used for the GM's, GM's motive or whatever narrative they have in store. And I think also communicating with the players a bunch as well, like understand fully what their wants are and put out your wants as well. A lot of the time I'm like, I have a concept for a character, here's what I want. And people would jump onto that, be like, oh, that's cool. Can we connect in this way? Can we connect in that way? A really big example of that is I play in a Pathfinder campaign called Stormforge. And I've wanted to play a husband, like a couple dynamic for a long time. Like I thought it'd be really cool to play a couple, like from the get-go, not like a couple that happens during a campaign. I have a lot of people who love romance in campaigns, so I'm kind of guaranteed to have that at some point. But an established couple from the get-go in a campaign. And Just Sam on Twitter was like, I want to play this out too. Let's do this. So we played a married couple. We're playing a married couple in a Pathfinder campaign. And it's a lot of fun. Like, it's a lot of fun. It's really enhanced. I think it's really enhanced Pathfinder for me as well. Because, I don't know, there's something about coming into a game with a pre-established relationship with a character. It makes it a lot easier to kind of feel like you lived in this world. So yeah, put your wants out there. And don't be afraid to play archetypes and tropes. Even if you want to fully follow it or if you want to subvert it, go ahead, do it. Another game I was in was called Kingmakers, and I played a prince who lost their right to the throne to their brother. And it was heavily inspired by Scar, like right down to like he actually had a scar down his face. When we got art, I gave images of Scar as a like reference. Because we were like, I want to really lean into, at the very least, the physical aspect of this guy's gonna be a bad guy. I then get to choose whether or not I want to follow that trope to the T or if I want to subvert during play. So yeah, I think especially when you're beginning, don't be afraid to play tropes or play yourself. That's another thing. If you're beginning, don't be afraid to play yourself. Because that's still a thing that's okay.
I think that all those things kind of have a thing in common that I've been thinking about a lot lately of like, if you're playing into a trope, if you're playing yourself, if you're playing into like, if you're playing into a pre-established relationship, you always have that like one thing that you can fall back on when you don't know what to do, which is why I think our Orbital Blue season was so successful, because that game tells you when you don't know what to do, make it sad.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's going to be a time when you're embodying a new character that you get to a juncture, you get to a decision point where you don't know what that character would do. The second you have a like firm backdrop of, I can lean on my in-game spouse, I can lean on this trope that I know very well, I could just be myself, then that becomes very easy to play. And those are things that can often be the most like tricky to navigate when you just reach a point where you're like, I don't know what I would do here.
Yeah, because I think there's a kind of like disconnect, or like, I don't know the term for it, but like a lot of people think having a thing to fall back on means that they're playing a two-dimensional character. And I don't think that's the case. I think having a thing to fall back on is very three-dimensional. There's times where I'm like, I definitely, like, having a personality trait, having a thing that people can be like, that's very Drac of you, it still makes you three-dimensional. It just so happens that you have to, one of the three dimensions is a thing that you constantly lean on, you constantly do. And that's okay. And that's okay for a character to also have that. So like, yeah, like leaning on a spouse was like a big thing, because for me as a character, we have a very heavy, like packed campaign, and it's great. I absolutely love it. It's probably one of my favorite campaigns I've been in. But there are definitely times where I'm like, I don't know how to convey that this is him wearing a mask. Like this is him not showing his true self. But then having a spouse, I can be like, okay, cool. It makes sense for my character to show their real self to that spouse. And now this establishes that this thing that they show to a stranger was just a mask, or was just them pretending or faking or hiding their actual hurt or whatever. So yeah, don't be afraid to lean on something. Don't be afraid to lean on a trait or a tick or whatever that character might have.
I guess for the producers listening who maybe the only sorts of people who have listened to our deep dive on budgeting, but for the actual play producers out there who are like, I want, you know, Draconics on my stream, on my podcast, because they make super interesting, like, unique characters. What's an easy yes for you when you get a casting email?
Oh, this will kind of lean into what you should do as a producer as well. Give me every single piece of information you have, please. I've reached a point where I'm okay asking questions, but I've, as a producer and as someone who was once a beginner, it's very hard and I think very nerve-wracking, especially for marginalized people, to ask questions, to ask follow-up questions. Because a lot of the time, like, we have the kind of notion of like, oh, if I ask questions, I'm going to be too much. I'm going to be a lot to handle. I don't want to be a lot to handle. And while you might be very welcome and be like, please ask questions, put them in a position where they don't need to. So if you reach out to me, like, give me everything. Give me, like, when I produce, I give potential casts. Like, even if people haven't said yes yet, I'm like, I've reached out to these people, so they are potentially going to be players. I hope to have this much funding. You're going to get paid, hopefully, this much. Lay it all out for them. And also, in my case, often I'm reaching out to these people before sponsors. I'm like, we're going to hopefully have this much money to give you. That's fine, even if it's not confirmed. So, like, honestly, the same to me as a player. If I can get as much info in the initial email or whatever from the get-go, that goes a long way of helping me decide if I want to play. Also, honestly, right now, because my mood is always changing. I'm just really in a sci-fi mood right now. So if you hear me with sci-fi, I'm probably going to say yes. Or like horror, I want to do more horror. But I think horror for me specifically is going to be it'll be harder for me to say yes to, because I think at least for me, I've had very awful experiences playing horror with like strangers. So I'm usually going to be playing horror with like people I'm comfortable and feel comfortable with. But sci-fi is a pretty solid bet, especially with Doctor Who. It's very much reignited my love for sci-fi and science fantasy.
Chudigatois, absolutely
he stole the show the moment he showed up. It was incredible. I felt the baton being passed the moment he opened his mouth. I was like, yep, he's the doctor.
I was also like, I wasn't ready. I don't know if we'll keep this in, but I wasn't ready for the doctor to be hot. Like David Tennant, like other previous doctors have been like attractive, but they weren't like, this guy is attractive.
And you can tell that they know this with all of the costume changes. They're like, we need to have him in everything. We need to.
Oh my God. I can't wait. Wait, I had a thing and now I'm thinking about
it. You had a real thought, but you got distracted by how hot he is.
How hot Chudigat was. As far as like producers sending out as much information as possible, that's actually a note I took from you that I've done better since I think we talked for the 20-sided newsletter. I sent out very detailed emails with everything in it, but I think I had neglected to include was like who I was thinking of casting, mostly because I was sending out these emails initially and I was like, I don't want to tell anybody that like this person's going to be in it and then they say no or something.
Yeah.
But it is like, this is one of the most collaborative art forms. People want to know who they're going to be working with.
Yeah.
And I was like, that makes absolute sense that I should be sending that out to people.
I had like an awful experience of like, as a producer, of like having to say, sorry, you can't play, because I learned that several people had a problem with one of the people I'd reached out to. And they found out like in the call of session zero that they're playing with this person. Like after that experience, I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to like make that a thing that happens right at the beginning and obviously make it clear that, hey, I've only reached out to these people so that there's no disappointment of like, they didn't say yes, sorry. Like they know that they say kind of possible, but not a certain thing. And also let people say, no, thank you, I don't want to play, when they see a name that they don't want to play with. Because unfortunately, even as great as the AP and TTRPG space is, there are some bad actors and there are some people who have just like personal history that maybe isn't even publicly known with people. So giving them the chance to back out without having to give any details is always nice. And a good way to do that is giving the names of even just potential cast. And same with sponsors, actually, as well. Every time I reach out to a sponsor, I reach out to the cast first to be like, hey, are you cool with me reaching out with this company, this brand, this person? So again, I'm not keyed in as I should be, or not even keyed in as I should be. I don't think anyone should be keyed in. Don't be online more than you need to. But there are things that you might not know of. There are things that there might be history of companies or people that you don't know of. So letting your cast know and then letting them be like, oh, actually, I'm not comfortable with this because did you know that they did this thing 5 years ago? I'm like, oh, cool. I've only got into the industry 4 years ago. I didn't know that. Thank you for letting me know. And avoiding that possible awkward moment.
I think listeners of My First Dungeon will probably know you as like someone who comes in with very interesting character ideas.
Yeah.
I think you coming in with blank as someone on a podcast who's going to not speak was a pretty interesting character idea. And one that me as a producer was a little worried about when we started. But obviously it turned out amazing. I'm curious, in your opinion, what is your approach to making interesting characters? Like, what inspires you? What informs, like, those really big choices? And then of the characters you've made, what character, in your opinion, on whatever metric you think you'd want to measure this on, do you think has been your most successful?
So the tropes, I mentioned tropes earlier because a lot of my characters start off as tropes and I build off of that. And I don't know, so I have no theater background. I'm one of those kids who I have full STEM. I did no real public speaking. Like, I got into streaming because I wanted to get over my social anxiety, like my public anxiety over speaking in public. So I don't have anything like professional background in acting or anything like that. So I found tropes, like finding a trope or an archetype and then building off of that really helped. And a lot of the times I find those tropes or archetypes in my favorite shows. So for Blank specifically, there's an anime called Durarara. And one of the characters there it's kind of like, think urban fantasy. And one of the characters is a Dullahan, a headless horseman. But in this show, they instead of a horse, they ride a motorbike. Instead of a pumpkin for a head, they have a motorbike helmet for a head. And they don't have a head, obviously. They don't have an actual speaking head. So they communicate through a sidekick. They type their whatever they want to say and communicate through that. And I was like, that's really cool. I really like that. That's a cool concept. And I kind of like just kept that way in the back of my head. And I actually talked to Shanook about this. Then a couple of years afterwards, I watched a D&D campaign. I can't remember what it was called, but I watched a D&D campaign that was all disabled people. And one of them was deaf. And in the campaign, in the session, they used minor illusion to create closed captions underneath themselves so they could communicate. And that like hit me. That hit me really hard, I think, of like, whoa, wait, accessibility. That's cool. Like, accessibility in D&D, that's really cool. Yeah. They didn't like homebrew anything. They didn't like make anything new. They just used a thing that existed and made it accessible. And I was like, okay, I really want to do something with this now. So that kind of resurfaced the Durarara character of using a sidekick to communicate because they're mute. I was like, I want to play a mute character in this game. I'm just going to do that. So I kind of like take archetypes, take tropes, take basic bits of a character and play with it. Another one I haven't got to play yet, but I've brainstormed and I've talked to my GM and they said that Dan would be playing is playing just the head of a headless horseman. Right.
I was going to say, I saw this on Twitter some time ago and I was like, Draxton is weird character era.
And I thought it would just... I found for that one, I found a limitation that I wanted to play around with because, okay, this is going to go into higher education now. Higher education, I played a character called Barugash, who was a Gorgon. And I wanted to build this character out as a student. Like, it was a Strixhaven campaign and they're a student. And I was like, no student's going to have like, realistically, no one's going to have like firebolt. Like, they're going to have things that help them in class. They're not going to have like danger spells. So I took all utility spells and I had just no damage dealing spells and I played with that limitation on myself and found it was so, so fun. Like, we played a game of like some like classic magic school game of like everyone's given temporary hit points, like 40 temporary hit points, and you have to bring it down, their temporary hit points to zero, and then they are out of the game. It's like dodgeball or something like that. And I was like, I don't have any damage dealing spells, but I have enhanced ability, which gives you temporary hit points. And I know that the rules in D&D is that temporary hit points don't stack. They replace each other. So I'm going to replace their 40 temporary hit points with the three I produce with enhanced ability. So I did that. I touched them and cast enhanced ability. I remember everyone at the table being like, why are you enhancing the enemy? And I was like, I'm going to replace all of their hit points with, and I roll a dice, a d6, three temporary hit points. In one move, I knocked them from 40 temporary hit points down to three. Like, getting to play with those limitations is so, like, it scratches an itch for me.
Enhance ability as a damage-dealing spell is so good.
Because I remember reading and being like, it doesn't say willing creature, so I don't have to be willing. So I can just do it. Because like, obviously writing the rules, they were like, no one's going to give an enemy a bad guy temporary hit points. Don't include willing. It's fine. So I read it and I was like, yeah, I can do this. So yeah, I remember taking them down immediately. And I was playing like a nerdy character. So I was like, everyone's like, oh, this nerdy character just destroyed a sport that we all thought was just brute strength. So like playing with those limitations was really fun. So after coming from there, I was like, how else can I limit my spell list? And then I was like, yeah, I'm going to play the head of a headless horseman. And I'm going to limit my spell list by casting spells that don't have somatic components because I don't have hands. I can't cast anything in my hands. So that's kind of where that was born from. So you can, I don't know, you can just take inspiration from different things. I take it right now from like mastering a system and then limiting myself in that system, or taking things from media and being like, I wonder what I can do with this archetype and play with and expand on. Because I think it's okay to be like, cool, I love seeing this character. I wonder what I would do in that world. And then just do that. That's fine. You can do that. It doesn't have to be completely from scratch, but you can also build on that if you want.
Well, we can't wait to see what crazy idea you have next. So, Drac, we love to end all of our conversations with a final question of what are you bringing to the table? And so this is a recommendation to our listeners. It could be a person, a game, a show, a resource. It could be tabletop related or it could be not tabletop related. So, Drac, what are you bringing to the table today?
Truly, I recommend Stella Luna. Stella Luna TV on Twitter, or Stella Luna on Twitch, for anything like overlay and social media graphics related. They are my go-to. Truly, after I saw their first thing for Unbound, which is one of the campaigns they ran, I was like, I'm only going to commission you for overlay stuff, and I haven't stopped ever since. Every single project that I've been a producer of, Stella's been the graphic designer for the overlay and the social media like graphics of. So I definitely recommend commissioning them when they have their open. I don't think they ever publicly say like, oh, my commissions are open. So just email them. The email's in their Twitter handle and their Twitch. But yeah, just check them out, commission them for anything overlay related because it'll be gorgeous. They actually I believe they actually won the overlay for Goodyear. The overlay for Goodyear won an award in the New Jersey
Webfest, yeah.
I think, yeah. So they're an award-winning overlay designer. So get in on that.
Thank you so much, Drac, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter or social media, but honestly, mainly Twitter, at Draconics. That's Draconiques. And a bunch of different campaigns, like Stormforge over on Captain Robert's channel. Going to be on Stella Luna's channel again. Pablo Ultima campaign called Our Lives After. So you can check that out on Stella Luna's channel. And God, what else? I got some other projects in the works I can't talk about, so just follow me on Twitter to find out about them when they come out.
And we will link all of those things in the show notes. Keep an eye on Drac in 2024 and hire them to be on your show. Because people have done it three times, it is worth it every time.
And if you want more gaming content from us, check out the 20-Sided newsletter or the Many-Sided Media Discord. Both of those links are in the show notes below. Rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcast. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're hearing this, that means you listen to every last second of this episode. And if you simply cannot wait until the next episode drops, you should head over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and become a member of the Dice Pool. Fresh! For just a few bucks a month, you'll get cast talkbacks, original games, and a full-length bonus actual play each and every month. As of the end of 2023, there's already over 20 hours of bonus audio, plus a whole bunch of other goodies to enjoy. So head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and jump on into the dice pool. We'll see you there. Splash!